Okay, so I was asked to give the exact same talk from a different perspective, so I'll try to do that. And James, stop me anytime if I say anything that's not correct, or if you disagree. Okay, so I'll talk about some of the statistics issues that comes up when you try to detect discrete spectral features from a gamma ray burst X-ray afterglows. So this is work that I've done with Bob Rutledge and Fiona Harrison. Okay, so James did most of the important introduction to this topic. So I'm just going to emphasize some of the things that he didn't say. The reason why we want to detect X-ray lines from GRB afterglows is because there's a lot of things you can potentially do with X-ray spectroscopy. X-ray spectroscopy is very powerful. It's very unique in the sense that the X-ray band contains essentially, it contains discrete transitions from essentially all of the astrophysically abundant elements, from carbon all the way up to nickel, if you wish. So if you can detect X-ray lines, it's potentially very powerful. By measuring intensities of lines from various elements, you can get estimates on the abundances, which gives you information about the progenitor star, for example. If you have a high-resolution spectrum from, say, Chandra or Exmoor-Newton, you can measure velocities, understand the dynamics, which may tell you something about the burst environment and geometry. Also, if you have a very nice spectrum, very nice X-ray spectrum, you can determine the excitation mechanism directly just by looking at the line ratio, for example. So you don't have to rely on assuming that this is a thermal plasma or a recombination-dominated plasma photoionizer or whatever. You can directly measure temperatures and densities if you have a very nice spectrum. And that will give you constraints on whatever models you may have. There has been many CCD resolution type observations with Exmoor-Newton and Chandra, and there has been a few high resolution spectroscopic observations with Chandra as well, and some of them have published reported line emission detections. So this wasn't actually the first paper that came out, but this was the first high resolution Chandra grating observation that was published. And this was GRB 991216 from the Chandra high energy transmission gratings published by Piro et al. In 2000. So what they saw was that this is wavelength increasing that way, so energy increases this way, and number of counts. What they saw was that there was an excess feature at around 3.5 keV, or 3.5 angstroms. Roughly similar. They see this excess emission on an assumed power law continuum. And they said that this line has a single trial significance of 4.7 sigmas, which is pretty high. 4.7 sigmas, by the way, is something that happens once in about 380,000 random trials at this particular energy. So if you assume that you expect the line here, then your significance is going to be a 4.7 sigmas. They also reported this other blip over here, and identified possibly as a radiative recombination continuum. This is something that you get if the plasma is not thermally excited by electrons. This is something that you get if the plasma is photoionized. So the electron temperature is much lower than the ionization potential of the iron line, so it's essentially over-ionized relative to the electron temperature. By the way, this burst has an optical redshift of 1.02, and this line happens to be, if you adopt this redshift, it happens to be iron 26 line, which is Lyman alpha hydrogen, like iron. And of course, James showed you a lot. He told you a lot about this burst. GRB 011211, this was, let me just briefly summarize. It was an XMM observation And there was a claim detection from the first 5 kiloseconds of the observation that there are line-like features. It has an optical redshift of 2.14, and it was claimed that the lines were blue-shifted relative to this optical redshift by a velocity of about 10% of the speed of light. Significance using an F-test was about 3 sigma, and using Monte Carlo, they estimated that the significance is 3.7 sigma. So the first paper that came out was a Nature paper that James wrote. A year later, they, since Nature doesn't want all the details about data analysis, they Reeves et al. Wrote a follow-up paper summarizing all of the, describing all of the detailed Monte Carlo that they did. So this is another plot that that James showed earlier. So this is going to be a rebuttal to a rebuttal to a rebuttal. So let me just briefly tell you what can go wrong with this kind of analysis. So what they did was they took the XMM spectrum of 01, 12, 11. They included 3 lines or 5 lines. And they recorded the delta chi-squared that resulted from adding those additional lines to their model. And they got a delta chi-squared of 20 point something. Okay. What they did next was they simulated 10,000 of these realizations using Monte Carlo, assuming that the emission comes from a pure absorbed parallel. So they simulated 10,000 spectra. And then they went back and fit the simulated data with and without the emission lines, and recorded the delta chi squared, the decrease in delta chi squared that resulted from adding those additional lines, and they made a histogram of that. So the claim was that out of the 10,000 simulated spectra, they got more than delta chi squared of 20. Reduction in only about 3 or 4. So that turns out to be a significance of about 3.7 sigma. But you have to be careful though, because you're not going to be analyzing your 10,000 simulated spectra like you analyzed your real XMM Newton data, right? So you're going to be adding your continuum and lines at arbitrary energy when you start the fit, and then you probably just type fit and let the program find a minimum. When you do that, you're most likely going to end up in a local chi-squared minimum and not a global chi-squared minimum. So instead of getting a distribution that looks like that, if you had the time or if you had enough students to do this, to actually analyze carefully the 10,000 simulated spectra, instead of getting a distribution that looks like that, you're most likely to get something that would look like that, because you're almost always going to be stuck in a local minimum and not in a global minimum, especially if you have five emission lines in your model, having all the energies flow and the normalizations and all that. I don't think there's any way you would automatically find a global minimum. And the same for the thermal model case. Since you have so many parameters, you're very unlikely to be finding a global minimum. Anyway, so let me just say a few things about the paper that Bob and I wrote in 2002. This was the rebuttal to the rebuttal, so maybe I should have shown this first. But anyways, we said, okay, you look at the data, you can actually fit the data with an absorbed parallel and get a very reasonable reduced chi-squared. So we said, okay, assuming that the data can be represented by an absorbed parallel, let's simulate 10,000 of these spectra and calculate or determine how many Monte Carlo realizations would have features that correspond to, you know, the typical features that you see in the data at any arbitrary energy, because there's no model that gives you a good estimate of what the velocities of these lines are. So you really have to be doing a blind search, not a targeted search. You just don't know where to look at. So the solid line here is the data that's actually been convolved with the spectral response. So it's kind of like a match filter approach. You would you'd be most sensitive to features that are roughly comparable to the width of the instrument resolution. The two lines here correspond to 99% and 99.9% upper limits based on the parallel, absorbed parallel model that we got from fitting the data at any at that particular energy as a function of energy. So you see this blip here in the data that touches the 99% line. So that means that a line brighter than an emission line brighter than this curve over here would occur only once in 100 trials at that particular energy. Okay. But what you have to do in reality is, since you don't know where the since you don't know the energies of the lines, you have to ask the question, you know, what are the chances of finding a line that reaches the 99% curve at any given energy? So it turns out that if you do that exercise, you see these that sort of fluctuations at 99% and 99.9% in about 20% of all the simulations that we do. So we concluded that, you know, the real significance of these two features that correspond to silicon 14 and sulfur 16 that James identified to be significant at 1.3 sigma and not 3.7 sigma. So it's not significant at all, in our view. So after that, I went ahead and looked at all of the available X-ray follow-up observations from ASCA, Bepple-Sachs, Chandran, XMN, and identified 20 data sets that had more than 100 counts in the data. So it was kind of, this number is kind of arbitrary, but we had to set a limit somewhere. So 16 of the 25 observations were CCD resolution observations. And five of them had Chandra gratings in it, so they had about two orders of magnitude higher spectral resolution. We concluded that none of the previously claimed detections are not statistically significant using the method that I just described. But there are a few notable cases. James also pointed out these two GRBs, 030227 and 040106, that do show significant blips in the spectrum, and I'll show you a few cases there. But let me go back to the first Chandra grating data that came out. So if you look at this plot, and you look at the continuum that they adopted, you realize that essentially, let's see, I don't know, 80% of the data points are above the adopted continuum. So if you do that, you're obviously going to end up with statistically significant you know, emission lines. The way they determined the continuum was not from this data, but from a zeroth order spectrum. If you're familiar with Chandra HETG observations, you get data from the dispersed light as well as a non-dispersed zero order light. So they determined the continuum from the zero order light, which you shouldn't do because this was a bright burst and there must have been pileup. And other issues. So I don't know why they decided to do this. But if you just take the data and try to fit it with an absorbed parallel, you get a really nice fit. Okay. So if you do that, this blip over here has a single trial probability significance of about 2.3 sigma. That's single trial. This particular GRB has an optical redshift, and you could identify this line as one of the real X-ray transitions. So it's not clear what kind of statistics you should use. But you can see that even in a single trial case, the significance is only sigma. So there's no point in carrying it further. So these are the Monte Carlo results. The red curve corresponds to 99% single trial. The blue curve corresponds to 99.9% single trial. And it turns out that this line over here has a, oops, I think, sorry, there's a typo. 2.3, I think this should be 2.8. 2.8 sigma single trial. If you try to calculate the blind search probability, you see that roughly 40% of all the simulations that we do have a blip that exceeds the 99% curve. It turns out that if you the MEG, HETG has a high energy gradient and a medium energy gradient. If you look at the medium energy gradient, there's in fact an even more significant feature than the one you see in the HEG. It's only 3.5 sigma single trial, but it's still more significant than the one that was published. So I'm wondering why this wasn't in the paper. Just to show you some of the four examples of a Monte Carlo simulation that we did. You see similar things in your Monte Carlo, and that's not surprising because that's where the effective area peaks. So if you had an effective area that looks like that, it's not uncommon to have a peak roughly at the effective area peak. Okay, another case, GRB 030227. This was another thing that James showed. another observation of XNM. In this case, Watson et al. Claimed to have seen discrete emission lines in the last 10.9 kilosecond of the observation. This one doesn't have an optical redshift, but they inferred that the Z from the X-ray lines is at 1.4 or so. And the claimed significance of these lines was 4.5 sigma. These are the Monte Carlo results. This is the PN data from EPIC. This is the PN data from EPIC and the Monte Carlo simulations. So you see these two blips, which correspond to silicon and sulfur that they identified, are significant at 99.9 and maybe just above 99% single trial. If you ask the questions, what are the chances of getting something like this at any arbitrary energy, it turns out that you get these things roughly 15% of the time you do the simulation. So it's formally significant at 1.5 sigma or so. You look at the MOS data, EPIC, the XMM Newton has two different sets of CCDs. If you look at the MOS data and line up the locations where you see blips in the PN data, you just don't see anything. Okay, so that was the last 10.9 kiloseconds of the data. If you look at the entire spectrum, which had an exposure time of 35 kiloseconds, you do see something that's significant. I'm not going to claim anything, but just statistically, if you zoom into this region over here, you can see that there are regions where the data go above or below the 99.9% confidence regions in the PN data, but really nothing in the MOS. So if you calculate the significance, statistical significance of these guys, it's formally significant at, I think, 3.9 sigma multi-trial, but it's not seen in the other CCD camera, so it's hard to make any sense out of this. The last one that I'm going to talk about, 040106, which James also talked about, has a significant blip at roughly 0.6 keV. It has a formal multi-trial significance of about 4 sigma, but again, you don't see that same blip in the other camera, so you really don't know what to do with it. Okay, so at what sigma should one get excited? This depends on who you are, but if you're actually willing to bet money and make an investment in this, let me just give you a few tips. So the 3 sigma feature, by definition, is something that happens once if you try 370 times. So if you knew exactly where to look for in your spectrum, if you knew exactly what line to expect at any given energy, and you had three sigma detection, then you should be willing to bet $370 to win $1. Okay? But for most of these GRBs, you don't know what the outflow velocities are. You also, in more than half of the cases, you don't have an optical redshift, so you don't know where to look for in your spectrum. So if you had, say, 370 resolution elements in your spectrum, then you should almost always see a three sigma feature in any spectrum. So these two quotes really nicely summarize what I wanted to say in the last 12 slides. Bob Kirshner has said in his book that if you believe Gaussian statistics, you should be willing to bet your goldfish at four sigma. So none of these things are at four sigma multi-trials. So if I were you, I wouldn't bet any money on it. Okay, also, as I said, most of the claim detections had a formal significance of 3 to 4 sigma. And these were all independent of your quality of the data. If you had very good data, you didn't see any lines. If you had very low statistical quality data, you sometimes see lines, but you sometimes didn't see lines. So there's no, it was always at 3 or 4 sigma, irrespective of the source brightness or exposure time. Also, some of these features appear to be transient, seen in only a selected time interval of your total exposure time. And also, you have to keep in mind that a 3 to 4 sigma feature has a much larger equivalent width, and it looks line-like if your quality of the spectrum is not great. So even if you had, even if you take your parallel quasar spectrum that you get from XMM or Chandra and take, the first 5,000 photons, you will see that the spectrum looks line-like, and it's easy to be fooled. I won't say much about recent SWIFT observations, except that there were about 10 X-ray afterglow observations that have been published. None of them have any reported detections of any obvious X-ray lines. XMM and Chandra and even Suzaku followed up many of the SWIFT GRBs. The CCDs on XMM and Chandra have 10 times the effective area of the X-ray telescope on SWIFT. So in principle, you can get a deeper spectrum. Again, there hasn't been any reported detection since SWIFT went up. So I think we've explored quite a large space in parameter space. I don't think there are any high equivalent width metal lines in the X-ray spectra of GRB afterglows at T less than 2 days. I don't think we've had any deep observations of afterglows much after a few days from the GRB. But it's still possible that there are weak narrow lines or weak broad lines. We just haven't explored that parameter space. For the weak narrow lines, you can try to follow up a very bright GRB that you get from SWIFT, for example. So we have an approved Chandra TOO program. 120 kiloseconds with the low energy transmission gratings to follow up the next brightest GRBs. The weak broad lines are going to be very difficult because in order to detect weak broad lines, you need very high statistics, which may not be possible with the current X-ray satellites. So I think I'll stop there and answer questions.
I perhaps should be the last person to say anything after hearing those two talks, and I fully agree with many things you said, but just coming from the place I am coming, I've seen people excited over many things where the sigma was outside the range you actually mentioned. So we are all humans, and
but you're from Los
Angeles. I'm from UNLV.
No, I'm not. I wanted to make clear that I'm not an anti X-ray lines person. I did my PhD thesis on X-ray spectroscopy. I do like these things, but I think they're possible. We just don't think. I just don't think that we've seen any in the current data.
I just wanted to comment that your remark on one or two slides before this about the increased effective area for Chandra and XMM and Suzaku isn't really relevant because the X-ray intensity drops by typically 3 or 4 orders of magnitude in the first hour after the burst goes off, and none of those observatories can get to them that fast. So the higher effective area doesn't really help you.
You're right.
So what you have to hope for there is that these things are somehow time variable, mm-hmm. and that the fact that SWIFT isn't seeing them is simply because we're looking too soon. And you know, you have to hope that maybe, clearly the GRBs are time variable phenomenon mm-hmm. in general, and it's not unreasonable to think that the lines might be also time variable if there are lines. But I would have to agree that I haven't been convinced too much yet.
I think the fastest that Chandra can get to a GRB is probably 20 hours after the burst.
Yeah, and lately it's been more like 24 or 48 in my experience.
Yeah, but XMM and Suzaku can probably get to it in, I don't know, 5-6 hours in some cases. But you're right, you know, the X-ray flux is still decaying pretty rapidly. So
I don't want to start another rebuttal, but so actually just on, firstly on 011211, I was coming to the conclusion actually that the differences were due to the fact we were actually getting different delta chi-squares, not actually the method of Monte Carlo, because we did actually at least do our best. I know XSPEC is not perfect, but we did try and map chi-square space as a function of energy, and maybe, you know, that wasn't clear from the papers. But it was just a question of where you actually put the continua as to what the significance was of adding the lines. But I actually agree. I mean, even in the most optimistic case, it's no more than 3 sigma.
Okay.
The point for the number of bins you search in a spectra, in a CCD spectra, that might be there might be 50 or 100 resolution elements. Because if you look at a grating spectrum, it's going to be several hundred or even 1,000. So it might even be tougher in a way to find lines.
Sure. Yeah. But you have to agree with me that.
Oh yeah, I agree with you. No.
You still have to agree with me that if you blindly try to fit an X-ray data and add, you know, 3 or 5 lines at arbitrary energies, you're never going to find a global.
Any more? Ed.
I just wanted to remark that in optical spectroscopy, until the 70s, nobody bothered about these statistical types of things. Just people identified lines in spectra, like the solar spectrum is full of lines. But then in the 70s, there was the so-called discovery of promethium, which is a short-lived element with only, the longest-lived isotope is 12 years or something like that. And people claimed to find that in the spectrum of a star. And then for the first time, people started to do some statistical, to see how probable it is that these 5 lines were indeed due to promethium. And I think Charles Cowley was the first one to do a real statistical, and he developed a method now that you can really say what is the probability that I really found that and that element in the optical spectrum of a star, which is quite amazing because the Sun, of course, they found something like 60 elements had been identified, but nobody had ever looked at the probability that these elements are really there. And it's really interesting that you do this type of work.
But we haven't seen any yet, so there's a difference there.
So that's how chemical evolution started, right? Any more questions? We do have a bit more time, but if not, you can head home early. So let's thank all the speakers of today's session.